The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session.
Good morning. Please be seated. If the parties are ready on our first matter, we can go ahead and get started. If you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal, please so state.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alina Kilpatrick, and I'm a deputy public defender in Elko. I represent the appellant, Mr. Michael Polabel, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We come before you to ask this court to reverse the district court's judgment of conviction, finding the appellant, Michael Polabel, guilty of being a felon in possession of a firearm. We ask that you reserve the judgment of conviction because the statute dispossessing felons is unconstitutional as applied to the facts in this case under Article 1, Section 11 of the Constitution of the State of Nevada and the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution described by Heller, McDonald, and the recent Ninth Circuit opinion, Nordyke v. King. We've all discovered that the right to bear arms is experiencing a growth spurt, for lack of a better term. While the right has been fundamental to Nevadans since...
Counsel, as you talk about that, sure. What is the appropriate scrutiny for this case?
Your Honor, I suggest, Chief Justice, I suggest that we actually refuse to look at it in terms of scrutiny. My suggestion is that since we are dealing with something so fundamental that what we
So even with things that are fundamental, the court in the past has reviewed them. This court, as well as the United States Supreme Court, looking at scrutiny if a rule has been prepared that in some way may impact that fundamental right. They have not been absolute, so to speak.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, there have been a lot of questions that remain unanswered. I advocate for strict scrutiny, but instead of looking at it just as strict scrutiny or not as strict scrutiny, I think the best way to look at it is to think about it in terms of whether or not the accused, in this particular case we're dealing with a criminal statute, was using a firearm for a constitutionally protected purpose. If the purpose of the possession, or in another statute,
Are you arguing, though, under the Second Amendment, we have to look at McDonald and Heller, and both of those cases seem to categorically say legislation prohibiting felons in possession passes muster. What do we do with McDonald and Heller vis-a-vis your Second Amendment argument?
Well, what the justices said in McDonald and Heller in their respective footnotes makes no sense. And I suggest that we disregard it as being completely counterintuitive. Because if we think about it this way, okay, if we have a fundamental right, it is presumed that the state bears the burden to show a compelling state interest, okay? So how can a fundamental right as firearms be so fundamental and then a presumption of validity to say that in a footnote, we're going to leave these be, is in effect reversing a whole slew of cases saying that fundamental rights deserve the benefit of the doubt.
But you would concede that under McDonald and Heller read literally, just purely as a federal matter, this legislation would be okay.
Well, if we take what those two cases said in their footnotes, they're saying that, yes, this is presumed lawful federally. But there's a big difference between the felon dispossession statute federally and our felon dispossession
sure.
statute.
And then under the Nevada constitutional provision, you're arguing for a different standard. We can depart in interpreting Nevada's constitution from the federal Supreme Court's interpretation of the federal Constitution. But I'm having difficulty seeing how we as a state Supreme Court can change federal interpretation of the federal Constitution.
I don't think we need to. I think that as far as the federal Constitution is concerned, we can look at it as whether or not a statute is impeding a fundamental right. Like, by way of example, the right to keep a firearm in one's home for the purpose of defense. Okay? That, according to Heller, is sacred, it's fundamental, that's how we started it. Now, if we're going to look at the state constitution is a lot stronger in its language than the federal constitution. The meaning is so simple, it's so direct, it's so plain. It says every citizen has the right to bear arms for hunting and lawful purposes and self-defense.
Counsel, don't we have a checkerboard effect across the country in terms of how states are regulating this?
Yes. I mean, how states are regulating this and how different circuits are interpreting this is quite varied. It was only recently at this court, at the Chief Justice's order, that we looked at the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Nordyke.
And I guess more specifically, we don't have a specific carve-out provision in our state statute for home or business.
We do not. What we do have is our Constitution. And the Constitution references lawful purposes, hunting, and self-defense. So we can assume just from reading our Constitution from Article 1, Section 11, that those rights are guaranteed by the state constitution, whereas the only thing we've really got as of now as far as the federal constitution is the right to have a firearm in one's home for the purpose of self-defense.
Given the language of the state constitution and the circumstances under which it was passed, particularly the timing, does your client qualify as a citizen under the Nevada state constitution?
Yes, Your Honor, he does.
How?
Well, because he is a resident of the state of Nevada. He is a citizen of the United States. And he is, just because someone is a felon doesn't mean they lose their citizenship for the purposes of being a citizen of a state. So he is a resident here, a longtime resident, actually. And by virtue of that fact, he's a citizen. And he's
but
no longer
interpreting that provision, at least for the Nevada Constitution. The explanation of the bill noted that other state constitutions had not been interpreted by the courts to prevent prohibiting the carrying of concealed weapons or the possession of weapons by convicted felons. Did the explanation imply to the voters that in enacting this provision, convicted felons were excluded from the consideration of citizen?
Well, I think, Your Honor, when it reached the voters, it reached the voters in its plain language and not with an explanation or a memo attached to it from the Legislative Council. I mean, when the voters were voting on it, it's...
Well, I'm reading from the explanation to the question that was with the voters when they voted on it.
Oh, with the okay. Your Honor, the way I see it is the meaning of citizen is so plain that if the legislature wanted to include a caveat about felons, they could have, because other state constitutions.
They clearly discussed that in proposing this amendment.
They did.
It was discussed thoroughly, and that was a big concern. And it came down at the very last minute that. The concern wasn't terribly compelling because they would be violating the federal statute if an ex-felon would be in possession of a firearm. And that gave them some comfort, I guess, in passing this as it was worded.
Yes, I think as the legislative history
it was clearly
shows.
Their intent not to be contrary to the federal statute or the federal provisions.
No, it was meant to be in harmony, and I believe, given the fact that there was no exception in the amendment for felons that the federal law was supposed to act as a safety net regarding felons. And we can see that because there were so many proposals in this, in the legislative history of this bill, to add language that would say this should not be read to allow felons firearms. It should not be allowed to be read to allow concealed firearms without some sort of regulation. None of that's there. Now, at the time, in the early 80s, when the constitutional amendment was put forth, the exception for antique firearms did not exist, pursuant to the federal dispossession statute. But another interesting point is at the time in which this amendment was passed, felons were only prohibited from carrying concealed weapons, not from any weapon. So now a felon would be in violation of the law for shooting a potato through some PVC pipe, which is not what the statute intended and not what the Constitution intended. The drafters and the legislatures wanted to use the federal law as a safety net so that not only could they leave that to the federal government, but also so that there would be arguably some sort of uniformity. And that's another problem. There isn't.
Counsel, you're below your 5-minute mark, so.
Your Honors, Counsel Rob Lowe, Deputy District Attorney, Elko County, for Respondent, State of Nevada. The main issue is whether a felon is trustworthy enough to give a gun to.
And if I can have you digress just a little bit, if you can start us off with what do you think the scrutiny for review would be for this case?
Thank you. Judge, in this case, counsel told you it's an applied case. And in this case, as you see from the record, I'm not going to go over the facts. I know you know the facts, but the appellant was told the police he was out hunting with this black powder rifle. And so the level of scrutiny, under the federal constitution, Heller and McDonald are very limited cases. Right now, all we know is that they're limited to possession of a pistol inside the home for defense of harm to the home. That's all we know. Now, perhaps at some time the court will expand upon the Second Amendment, and presumably and hopefully they will, but that's all we know right now about the Second Amendment. It's the core, right? They said they've identified it in both Heller and McDonald. They said it several times, and they've reaffirmed it twice in Heller and once in McDonald. So that's all we know. And under the state constitution, it's a little broader. It's for lawful hunting, recreational defense as well. So what's the standard of review? Under the federal constitution, we would say at this point it's presumptively valid. So therefore, there would be really no standard of review. Or if we had to suggest a standard, a rationality review, rational basis, because this is conduct that's completely outside the Second Amendment. It's like in the and the courts of appeal have analogized frequently in this nascent Second Amendment jurisprudence to the First Amendment. And they said, well, you know, there's a lot of conduct in the First Amendment that's completely outside the First Amendment, child porn, obscenity, what have you, misleading false commercial
speech. So you would say that possession of a weapon by a felon is completely outside the protection of the Second Amendment based on Heller and McDonald.
Would. Heller and McDonald are talking about possession of a pistol inside the home for self-defense.
Well, but an originalist would probably see a black powder rifle as a weapon covered by the Second Amendment. So it's the gentleman's status as a felon that's, you say, categorically taking it out of the Second Amendment, correct?
You know, at some point, like I say, maybe the court will, and presumably they will, but so far all we know is, in both Heller and McDonald, it's the right to possess a pistol in the home for defense of hearth and home, as they put it. That's all we know. So maybe they will identify more rights under the First and Second Amendment, but so far that's all we know. And that's what it's limited to. That's what both Heller and McDonald are limited to.
Under the federal statute, would you concede that Mr. Palabo had the right to possess this weapon even though he was an ex-felon
under
or a felon?
Federal firearm statute or the
yes.
federal constitution?
Federal firearm statute.
No. No, because that says, yes, he would, under the federal statute, he would have the right. It is.
It would not be prosecutable for him to have, he could not have been federally prosecuted for possessing this black powder rifle, correct?
That's correct, because there is an exclusion in the federal statute for this kind of weapon. Now, assuming that Mr. Polabel met his burden of proof, because there is an exception in that statute, in that the muzzleloader section, for black powder rifles that can be retrofitted to fire fixed ammo, and I don't believe that was done below. So we don't have a good enough record, and the Circuit Courts of Appeal, the United States Circuit Courts of Appeal, said it's not shadow boxing; it's the defendant's case to put on to show that this is something that falls within the exception, and he hasn't done that in this case. He hasn't shown that this can't be retrofitted to fire fixed ammo, and a lot of muzzleloaders can't. Did I cut you off, Judge?
No, I was just going to ask you to follow up on Justice Douglas's question about the level of scrutiny that would be applied, if not under the Second Amendment, under the Nevada Constitution, in your estimation.
Well, I think the court hit upon it pretty well. Aside from the ballot measure, which told the public, similar language in state constitutions has not been interpreted by the courts to prevent prohibiting the possession of weapons by convicted felons. They were told by the Legislative Council that this would not prohibit the government from banning felons from having firearms. So they went into this and they voted on it. And, in over 2 years, in 79, 81, they're told repeatedly there's concern. It's replete with concern about felons having firearms, and they're thinking when they pass this that it's not going to allow felons to have a firearm. And then the public votes on it with that warning that it's not going to allow felons to have firearms. And so we would say this is conduct that is outside the Nevada Constitution as well.
What is the ambiguity you find in our Nevada Constitution that justifies us in consulting legislative history?
Well, I think there is some ambiguity because there's twice it says in the Constitution, lawful usage. And the question is, I guess then, how far does that lawful travel up inside the statute? I mean, twice they say lawful, but it's not in the first clause, up to the first comma. So you've got to wonder, did they mean entirely lawful conduct and lawful self-defense? And would felons have the right to possess a firearm even back then? So under the federal statute, and there must have been some concern there.
If you read that much into the word lawful, then the constitutional guarantee basically folds, because anytime you have a statute that says it's unlawful to do X with a gun, then it's unlawful. So I have trouble crediting the argument that inherent in the word lawful is the ambiguity.
The framers put it in there twice. They're certainly concerned with lawful use rather than illegal use of a gun.
What about citizen, the question that Justice Hardesty asked your colleague? Do you concede or do you argue that because Mr. Palabel was a convicted felon, he lost citizenship within the meaning of that Nevada constitutional provision as a civil right?
I believe that felons do lose their rights, and they can. They've been, since this amendment was enacted, the rights have been gradually restored. Now it's upon completion of honorable discharge from probation. But back then, it was a lot harder, I believe, to get.
Well, but at the time that the amendment was approved, what was the status of our jurisprudence in this state in defining a citizen? Did it include or exclude a felon?
Judge, I'm not certain about the definition of a citizen at the time that this was enacted.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what the statutes or jurisprudence said with respect to a felon's rights or lack thereof at the time this amendment was approved?
You know, I don't, and I've looked for a general statute that says you lost your rights. I found a statute that says you get your rights back, but I didn't find one that said you lost your rights. But it seems implicit if there's a statute that says you get these rights back that you did lose your rights. And in the legislative histories, that's what the legislature was thinking too.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that answers your question, but that's the best I could find, sir.
Mm-hmm.
So
in that regard, you would contend that the word citizen is also subject to some ambiguity, or it should be defined based upon the status of the jurisprudence at the time the Nevada constitutional amendment was approved?
I think there is some ambiguity, and I think that we should also look at the case law to find out if there is such an animal, to find out what the status was at the time this was enacted. But the felons have always been held to be categorically different from other law-abiding citizens. Heller tells us this is a right to defend your hearth and home against these kind of people that have been categorically found to be risky by the courts of appeal. And presumably people like Mr. Polabel who are seeking entry into your home. The question then, if not no scrutiny or low rationality review, then certainly intermediate scrutiny, substantial government interest, substantially effective means, and no less onerous alternatives, analogizing to the Second Amendment, expressive conduct, time, place, and manner restrictions, and certainly the government can meet those tests. There is an important government interest. Appellant has conceded that. The means are substantially effective because they keep firearms out of the hands of those who have been deemed to be dangerous and are presumptively dangerous. There's no less onerous way of doing that. We know these people are a threat to the public at large, and the law-abiding public.
Could you comment on the North Carolina Britt decision?
I can. Judge, we moved to get Mr. Polabel's PSI before the court because appellant suggested as pre-sentence investigation because counsel suggested that he's been law-abiding like Mr. Britt was for many decades. That's not the case, and so that's not before the court now. If you want me to comment further, I would. Regarding
no, I meant more on the issue of an as-applied challenge. As I understand it, Mr. Polabel asks in the alternative that the case be remanded for further proceedings in light of Britt and for the opportunity to more thoroughly vet these issues. Specifically, what I'd like to know is whether you should follow Britt and then her suggestion of a remand.
Well, certainly the idea of a remand is not a bad idea because nobody has passed on Britt yet. The district court didn't have a chance to pass on it. And
Counsel, Britt is a very unique set of facts. As I was going back and reviewing notes this morning, and I couldn't come up with an answer. I don't know what our felon population is in the state, but thinking about the impact to the courts, if we had every felon that wished to bear arms come before the courts at the local level for individual review, would we have time for anything else?
I think we'd need a lot more courts, and we'd need a lot more panels in this court to review appeals from the district courts, and be impractical to do that on a daily basis. It's a great question, Judge. Thank you. It's impossible everybody would be asking for their rights back based on the fact that they've been law-abiding for a couple of years or whatever. Britt was a very specialized case and unique, as far as I can find, among the reported cases. And it was several decades of being law-abiding, and Mr. Polabel didn't establish that below, that he had a record of being law-abiding for several decades. It's very sui generis and very limited to its facts. And
it's, you mentioned that you thought that lawful purposes was potentially ambiguous. I'd like to follow up with a question from what Justice Pickering had raised. Perhaps that was the intent of the provision, that subsequent legislatures could modify what was lawful as time passed.
Great point, Judge, and it brings up the issue of who should address this question. I mean no disrespect, but is it a question for this court or for the legislature to address? And in fact,
well, it kind of depends on how one interprets lawful purpose. Did lawful purpose mean those purposes that were in existence at the time the amendment was adopted, or did it contemplate subsequent changes to lawful purposes? I don't know. What's your view there?
All I can tell you is the court, they appeared in 1981 to be a little concerned about what might happen. Senator Bilbray says, other state Supreme Courts have determined that the wording does not preclude the state legislatures from passing acts that prohibit ex-felons from owning or having possession of weapons. Has any wording been suggested to amend or make it clear? We don't know what our Supreme Court would do. We hope that it would follow the precedent of other state Supreme Courts and some of the other states, but if it didn't, I think it would be a very serious thing that we'd have to consider. So what I guess they're saying is that they're concerned about whether it would be a legislative issue or something that's addressed to the judicial branch, and certainly a...
Well, wasn't the underlying purpose of this right extended to Nevada citizens to curtail gun control bills or measures by the legislature?
It was.
If that's true, then why would the court, why should this court interpret lawful purposes as permitting the legislature to enact subsequent legislation which has the effect of creating gun control measures?
The legislature, although they were concerned at the time about what a future legislature might do, I suppose that the legislature has authority to address these questions, and maybe they're best addressed to the legislature. And briefs, counsel, appellant says, well, my problem is I don't get my gun rights restored automatically, and a lot of states allow that. And those concerns are best addressed to the legislature that created the law, 202-360. This is something that should be addressed to the legislature. These are tough issues, and it's really for the legislature to address. If there's a right of return of firearms, the legislature needs to do it.
Any additional questions?
Thank you very much.
Ms. Kilpatrick?
Thank you. The state would have this court believe that a rational basis standard of review is appropriate, but with the seminal case of Heller, it's clear that it's not. Nordyke quoted Heller in saying, if all that was required to overcome the right to keep and bear arms was a rational basis, the Second Amendment would be redundant with the separate constitutional prohibitions on irrational laws, and would have no effect. So we know that it can't be rational basis. We have to go more than just a mere rationality. So even if we're going up to not a strict scrutiny, but someplace in between, the statute doesn't pass constitutional muster. There is no tailoring. The statute is about as tailored as a burlap sack. I mean, the only way that a felon can get his gun rights restored is to go before the pardons board. And every member of this court is on the pardons board, so I'm sure the court can take judicial notice of exactly how many pardons were granted last year felons actually got their gun rights back, maybe 19. So it's not something that that is easy to do. Now, when we're talking about going before a court to petition for gun rights to be restored, there are states where that is allowed to happen. As I referenced in my opening brief, West Virginia and Maine are states that allow a felon to go up and say, hey, I have been out of trouble for this long a period of time. I'm not violent. May I please have my gun rights back?
Counsel, you're talking about narrow tailoring. Does narrow tailoring have to be so narrow within a given subset, or is a narrow tailoring looked at as to the statute as a whole, where this only affects convicted felons, it doesn't affect the other class of people?
I think that it has to be looked at the statute as a whole. We're not making an equal protection argument, if that's what the court is thinking. We're not going there. What we're arguing is that because it's a fundamental right, laws that curtail fundamental rights don't get the benefit of the doubt, regardless of what Heather and McDonald say about presumptive validity, because those are counterintuitive thoughts. Now, the problem with this particular statute is that it is so broad in its scope. I mean, a potato gun is illegal, and there is no tailoring at all. It presents an undue burden to get one's rights back, going in front of the pardons board. And it cannot be said that there is a compelling state interest in keeping felons away from potato guns, or in this case, a black powder rifle that takes at least 45 seconds to load and only carries one shot. Lying in wait with a black powder rifle would not be particularly intelligent.
What about walking into a 7-Eleven with a black powder rifle and pointing it at the clerk?
I think, Your Honor, that that regardless of what weapon is used, I mean, it's going to present some form of danger, but arguably, given the fact that black powder rifles are not as reliable as some other forms of weapons, it would actually be, in my opinion, much easier to rob a 7-Eleven with a well-tailored bow and arrow, because you don't know some of these replicas where it's going to fire, misfire, or if it's going to backfire. I mean, they're not, even in the modern sense, they're not the most reliable of weapons. But yes, a felon could most definitely walk into a 7-Eleven and point a black powder rifle. But if a felon's going to rob
a... So why isn't that a legitimate concern?
Public safety is a legitimate concern, of course. But if a felon is going to rob a 7-Eleven, he's not going to say, hey, okay, I should probably use a black powder rifle instead of a pistol, because at least the black powder rifle, I won't be subject to an additional Category B felony. And with regard to the lawfulness issue, I believe that the lawfulness issue and the lawful purpose talks about the intent with which that the possessor had, not whether or not the status of being a felon is or is not lawful.
I have an additional question.
Go ahead.
You had mentioned during your opening remarks what the law was in 1981 in Nevada and federally with respect to people in Mr. Palable's situation. I wanted to understand exactly what you were saying with that. Under federal law, could he have legally possessed this black powder rifle as a felon?
In 1982, no. But in Nevada, he could have. There's a role reversal. In 1982, the exemption for antique rifles did not exist
In the federal law.
In federal law. Now it does. But also in 1982, the only thing that was illegal for felons was for them was prohibiting them from carrying concealed weapons. So everything's in the reverse now.
In 1982, could a felon have possessed any form of gun under a federal law?
No, I do not believe so. Not in 1982.
So when the voters voted on the amendment in 1981 or 82, they voted on it with that premise, correct?
Well, the ballot provision didn't define firearm, I don't believe. Or so, no. I mean,
I guess my concern is everybody seems to be, not everybody, you seem to be focused on the word firearm. And it
yes.
seems to me that one's focus, at least for the Nevada Constitution, should be on the word citizen.
Yes, and there's, with regard to the issue of citizenry, there is, it would be counterintuitive to think that someone that has completed their sentence in prison, paid his debt to society, and is off paper, off parole, or on probation, doesn't get his rights as a citizen.
But even in 1981, in order to get their rights restored, they had to go to the Pardons Board.
Yes.
Including the right to bear arms.
To bear non-concealed arms, yes.
Okay.
Counsel, you mentioned that term, paying your obligation to society. But don't we have different categories? Don't we have honorable discharge and dishonorable discharge?
Yes, we do.
In some cases, so that's another variable to consider. So it just isn't.
Right, but not all felons are, I would gladly have a barbecue with Martha Stewart. I mean, I doubt she's dangerous. I'm sure she could teach me a couple things.
It depends on who we talk to.
I'm sure.
with that, this is an item of interest across the country. It is unsettled, as the parties have so stated. That's why we ordered it up for oral argument this morning. Thank you very much for the arguments, sister.
Thank you.